In the days of 18 and 1, pagan all. In the days of 18 and 1, pagan all. In the days of 18 and 1, pagan shoes was all I'd done. Hand me down my pegs, my pegs, my pegs, my all.
I'm playing today on After Hours, and I'm Rick Cogan. Songs from a CD called Pete Seeger, American Industrial Ballads. Because, as many of us forget, Labor Day is meant, which is yesterday, to celebrate American workers, unions, the incredible fight for the eight-hour day. So yes, it's for barbecues. Yes, it's for sleeping late. Yes, it's for going to the beach, but it also has deeper meaning. In a couple weeks, on September 16th, there is a benefit at the North Shore Senior Center at which I have been asked to MC, and I gratefully accepted the offer to do that because I have been to the North Shore Senior Center a number of times, and I find it to be an oasis of not just really nice people, but nice and active and engaged and interesting and interested people. My friend Joan Golder has been associated with that place for a very long time, and she is on the phone. Hi, Joan.
Good evening, Rick.
Good evening to you. And your friend, who I have yet to meet, but I now admire because any friend of Joan Golder's is certainly a friend of mine, Molly Desposito, welcome to the show, and thank you for coming on.
Thank you, Rick. We're happy to be here.
I'm happy to have you because I have ever found, and I want to talk before we really get into the benefit portion of this, and you two talk about labor, you two being the co-chairs, being a co-chairs of a benefit is no easy task, is it? But you both were more than willing to do it, weren't you, Joan?
Sure, but we have a lot of help with this. We're not in it alone.
Well, but you two, I'm only doing it for you two. I'm doing it for the two of you. Joan, the North Shore Senior Center, every time I've been up there, and I've been up there a number of times to talk about my life and my books and Chicago, it is a beehive of activity. Could you tell the listeners a bit of its history? Because it started very small, did it not?
It certainly did. The North Shore Senior Center was founded in 1956, so it's a little over 60 years old, believe it or not.
Wow.
And it was founded really by a woman whose name was Janet Burgoon, and she was a social worker, and she realized that seniors needed socialization and activity. And so at the Winnetka Community House, it had two rooms, an office and a gathering room. And then it began to grow, and by 1991, it had truly outgrown its space. And Nutria West, the high school,
sure,
in Northfield, had space. And so North Shore Senior Center moved there in 1991. Again, it outgrew its space, and it was decided by the board of directors that we should actually own our own space and stop moving around the North Shore. So in 2000, the North Shore Senior Center moved down to its Arthur Nielsen campus on Northfield Road in Northfield.
The place I know right. And love.
Right, right. It was a warehouse. It had a few offices and an architect who specialized in senior structures made it into what you've seen today. It's a wonderful, wonderful place.
Well, it really is a beehive. And what I want to get at, Joan, how long have you, Joan Golder, been in? When is the first time you went to the North Shore Senior Center and why?
I went to the North Shore Senior Center, it's over 25 years ago. A friend invited me. I'd been active in other organizations and thought I was kind of winding down, and my friend said, well, what are you going to do with your time? And I wasn't sure. So a friend invited me to a board meeting, and the rest is history.
Hey, Molly Desposito, how long have you been associated with the North Shore Center? And how were you first introduced to it, and why did you become involved?
I attended Barra College in Lake Forest many moons ago.
Love that campus.
One of my faculty members, Joan Berman, was a board member at the time, and I had just finished a large volunteer activity as well, just like Joan. And Joan Berman said, you have to come over to the senior center and see what we're doing. So I did, and I began volunteering there in, it was 2004. So it's been, you know, a long time, 13 years, and it's been a wonderful, wonderful experience.
There sometimes is a kind of unfortunate stigma sometimes attached to the whole notion of senior center, where it's just where people get the notion, well, it's a room with a bunch of people sitting at card tables playing gin rummy or something. Do you know what I mean?
Exactly.
The North Shore Center is a place that totally altered my, if I did have that, I didn't have that silly a view of it. But it is, there are dozens of programs. That parking lot, Joan, as you well know, every time I go into that parking lot, I go, what are these people doing here? Who are all these people? It is, I'll say it again, it's a beehive of activity.
Well,
tell me about some of the things. Sure.
Let me tell you what's important is the mission of the Senior Center. And I'm going to read this, just short.
Sure.
And that will
read whatever you want.
It. Okay. The mission of the North Shore Senior Center is to foster independence and well-being of older adults, enhance their dignity and self-respect, and promote their participation in and contribution toward all aspects of community life.
Mm.
So, let's talk about the independence and well-being.
Sure.
Most people don't know that over 70% of the budget of the North Shore Senior Center supports the social services that it promotes. For example, it serves 23 communities from the south end of Evanston, beyond Highland Park, east, the lakefront communities, all the way out to Niles and Morton Grove in the west. And I could hardly believe this number myself. In 2016, 23,694 unduplicated seniors received services. So that's a major thing that we do. And what you see when you come, Rick, are the activities that are promoted by our part of our organization called Lifelong Learning, which has more than 200 classes and activities and events. For example, if you wanted to learn how to do some quilting, you could do that. Or if you wanted to stretch and breathe for better health, you could do that.
See, that's what I would be into. The stretching and breathing as opposed to the quilting would be what I would be into. But you also, one of the things, I'll never forget, we got to take a commercial break. I'm talking to my dear friend, Joan Golder, and my new friend, Molly Desposito. They are the co-chairs of the annual North Shore Senior Center benefit, which takes place on September 16th. We're going to talk a great deal more about that after the break. But I also want to tell you that when I went up there, Joan, to speak to a group, I guess it was called the Men's Club. Was that what it was?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Which I find terribly sexist, but I'm old-fashioned that way.
Rick, I have to interrupt. Women are now invited to the Men's Club.
Oh, now? Okay, I'll come back. Is that like you're inviting me back? Because that's my crowd. There were 250 guys there who, and I was just talking about, you know, writing for newspapers, who were more engaged, more interested in asking serious and provocative questions than any group I have ever spoken in front of. And that is some credit to the vitality of the North Shore Senior Center. While we take a commercial break, you folks can go online and everybody go. Wait a minute. You guys teach all that stuff, too, about online and how to.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, I mean,
oh,
that must
sure.
be.
Lots of computer classes.
Yeah, I'll bet. I'll bet. I'll bet. Go to www.nssc for North Shore Senior Center.org to learn a little bit more about it before we come back with Joan Golder and Molly Desposito to talk to talk intimately about the North Shore Senior Center. We'll be right back.
Lost my eyes in the blacksmith shop in the year of 56. While dusting out a tea.
That, in honor of Labor Day, is Pete Seeger from a relatively rare CD called American Industrial Ballads. I am on the phone for a few more minutes with Joan Golder and Molly Desposito, two lovely people and selfless people who have decided they downplay it. Joan, you so downplay, it's nothing to be a co-chair of an annual benefit. There's a lot of work involved. The benefit is September 16th with the theme Small Screen, Big Stars, an evening in support of the North Shore Senior Center. Again, at the North Shore Senior Center, one of your, it's not a slogan, but one of your philosophies is your chronological age doesn't matter, but your interests and needs do. You cover the waterfront when it comes to interests and needs. Can anybody walk in the door there, ladies?
Yes, anybody can walk in the door. Yeah.
Go ahead.
Anybody who might need help or anybody who wants to learn more about our world in many different aspects of our world.
Someone who needs, sometimes people lose their way after occasion. I'll never retire, but some people who do retire from jobs, they lose their friends, they lose their neighborhood tavern. And they kind of feel there's a loneliness that a place like the North Shore Senior Center can cure virtually overnight. Don't you think that's one of the? It doesn't matter if you're taking technology courses or literature courses or painting classes. That community is one of the great strengths of it, isn't it?
I would agree with you.
See, you guys.
I agree, Joan. Don't you think that it's really the socialization that's so important? But there's so many different ways to provide that the senior center can think of, and the other aspect, Rick, is that so many people have family members who need help.
Yeah.
So you might be the strong one in your family, but you might have a loved one who needs help, and so we have the siblings of individuals coming in and asking for help. And of course we also have our House of Welcome, which is a separate facility but on our campus, and it is for people who have some form of dementia.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That looks like a very, very nice facility too. I do love the whole notion of whether it is some kind of playful or interesting or intellectual activity balanced with providing medical information and all sorts of social service information. It's a wonderful balancing act out there because I think the place is so pleasant, and it's a relatively big staff of people taking care of people, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Now,
there are about 130 employees. Does that sound right, Joan?
Yeah, I think that's about it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so what I would recommend people listening who may not have heard of it, who may not have driven by it, it is in Northfield. It's very convenient. It services that entire, as Joan described, the entire North Shore area. A great time to experience it, I think, just because I'll be there, is the night of September 16th. You two, somebody put the arm on you. I know you're both very giving people, but still, being co-chairs of a benefit is not an easy chore. Did you two come up with the theme of the September 16th benefit? Small Screen, Big Stars?
Actually, one of the members of our staff, Patrick Price, who is the director of the development and marketing department, has come up with this wonderful theme, and the idea is that we're going to have a theme of early television. So we're looking at the 1950s and 60s programming, and we are having such a good time involving the party with us. We have some impersonators actors from the area. Yes, Lucy and Desi will be there. Howdy Doody. And Groucho Marx.
Oh my! You're not having. You want me to? Because I'm emceeing the thing. You want me to play Sergeant Joe Friday or
yes?
About that monkey that used? What about the monkey that used to be on the Today Show? What was that character's name?
Oh golly! Yes.
Yeah, I think it'll bring back a lot of memories. And the public is welcome to go to the benefit. Are they not?
Mm-hmm.
And this is what helps. Raise money for, and there, Joan, you mentioned the 23,694 people who receive services from North Shore Senior Center. You know, 6,000 of those are low income or living below the poverty level. There are 9,000 seniors were coached on their options from discharging the hospital and the Choices for Care program. You do so much there that it's. And, you know, given the current state of state finances and stuff, it's more important than ever, is it not, to raise those kind of funds?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And
most of our services are not paid for, even if a user is paying for them.
Right.
They're not paying the full price.
Of course
not. So everything
is
subsidized.
Now, are you two, Joan Golder and Molly Desposito, are you, I could ask you, Joan, I don't know you well enough, Molly, you're not dressing like 50 television stars to come to this thing, are you, on the 16th?
I'm not going to tell, Rick.
It's going to be a surprise. It's going to be a surprise. Well, what you two do out there, and you really are very giving, you have long records of this, you're both native Chicagoans who wound up going north to raise families. I would hazard to say that North Shore Senior Center is not just a gem of sorts, but it is an essential oasis in the North Shore. I'm going to ask you if you agree, and I know you both have to agree, don't you?
Well, when you think about
not only do I agree, but I like the way you put it. I like the words that you used.
Mm-hmm. When you think about the quality of life in a community, I think servicing your senior population is very important, and that's really a benchmark of what the North Shore offers.
Well, I also like the notion that it is so. You know, it has gone through various. You know, I don't know who the first person to walk in there. Maybe, I don't know, 15, 10 years ago, it said, hey, I need to send pictures. And my grandkids want to send me pictures, and I don't know how to use a computer. It's the needs of seniors, too, are constantly evolving, are they not?
That's very progressive, Rick. Mm-hmm. That's exactly what happened. Our computer programming department or programming services has evolved from just basic, here's the keyboard and here's what you call different things, to very sophisticated photography, cropping, sending photographs. And it's often the case. It's the grandchildren who want their grandparents to be in touch with them. And so they come to us for help.
Well, I think that just in keeping people of a certain age, and I think that age is expanding, too. I don't know what the life expectancy was 60 years ago, but it's certainly a lot higher it's certainly a lot higher now. That to keep people want to be engaged, just because they've stopped work in most cases doesn't mean they want to stop living, does it, ladies?
Oh, you're right. Absolutely. And it's interesting the age spread that we have. Molly and I are 15 years apart in age, Molly being the younger, and full of energy, and we're kind of examples of those who are there.
Well, I also like to think, and Joan Golder, I've known you for some time, and I literally do like to think of you as ageless. And I think that many
it's
of the
very
people,
kind.
It's not kind at all. It is true. I think chronological age is nonsense. It is how you live and how fully you live. And Molly Desposito, if you are a friend of Joan Golder's, you're a friend of mine. Just don't, when I come up there to MC the benefit on the 16th, do not be dressed in some costume. I want to really see. I want to see what you look like. I want to see
what
you look
like. I'm in
my
regular self.
Thank you, ladies. Thanks so much. I'm really glad to have told people. And you just drop in North Shore Senior Center. You can get all the information you need by going to nssc.org. That's for NorthShoreSeniorCenter.org. Take a look. Come to the benefit on the 16th, and I will say hello to you. Joan, I can't wait to see you, and Molly, I can't wait to meet you.
Same. Okay. Thank you so much, Rick.
Thanks, ladies. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thanks for having us.
Oh, my pleasure.
Good night.
My real pleasure. Good night to you. Don't turn off. Don't go to sleep, though. Keep the radio
on.
Keep the radio on, yeah.
Was in the town of Jacksboro in the spring of 73. A man by the name of Kriegel come stepping up to me. Said, how do you do, young fellas, and how'd you like to go and spend one summer pleasantly on the range of the buffalo? It's me being out of employment, old Kriegel, I did say. This going out on the buffalo range depends upon the pay.
Once again, that is the one and only Pete Seeger from a relatively rare CD. CDs are rare now. I understand most new cars don't even have CD players because you use your phone and plug in your phone. I'm playing Pete Seeger because Monday is Labor Day. And Labor Day is not just about barbecues and going to the beach. It's about work, celebration of workers and unions and the incredible fight for the eight-hour day, a lot of which took place here. We were trying to get Bill Page on the phone to talk about his new book, Everything I Know I Learned from Rock Stars. Pretty intriguing title, is it not? But we can't find him. I think he's in Texas. Who knows? So instead, I get to interview my great friend and a man I admire beyond words, Richard Lindbergh. Hello, Richard.
Rick, nice to see you.
How are you? It's always good to see you.
It's been a while, but I'm happy to be back.
Well, it's been a while because one of the problems is the publishing business these days does not lend itself, as it did in the old days, to being able to write a book every couple of years. The publishing business is crazy now, isn't it?
It is, and there's fewer opportunities, fewer publishers, fewer chances are taken on edgy books or books of specialized subject matter, and it's a pretty bleak landscape for somebody who has not published, who is trying to break in for the first time.
Oh, must be impossible. I mean, it just literally now must be impossible. I think the last time we talked, you've written pushing nearly 20 books about Chicago history and politics and crime and criminal justice and sports. I think the last time we talked, it was about you. I think yeah. The book was a very honest memoir titled Whiskey Breakfast, My Swedish Family, My American Life. That was not an easy book to write, was it?
Well, that is my favorite book of everything I've done.
It should be.
It was a 22-year writing project. To get it right, to rewrite it three or four times, to have a publisher tell me we got to rewrite it several more times. And it was a true labor of love. I'm hopeful of someday taking that book and getting it published in Sweden, where it should be republished.
Yeah.
That, too, is a very difficult thing these days.
Well, it also is a book that was in the writing basically your entire life, in a sense.
Yeah, it truly was.
In a sense. Not always a pleasant sense, but in
right.
a sense.
Right.
Your latest book, of which I have not even seen it. I am seeing it for the first time. It's like a coming out party for the book. It is called Northeastern Illinois University, The First 150 Years. Maybe, Richard, not as snappy a title as Whiskey Breakfast, but it tells the story. I had no idea that you, my friend, were a graduate of North.
I'll tell you something, Rick. I never thought college was in my future.
You were the first in your family to ever go to college.
Yes, of course, and I had no money.
But that's kind of generational about Chicago, too. I'd also like to welcome, and you can't see in here, well, I guess you can see on TV, Richard's pal and colleague, Mike Dizon, is it?
That's right, Mike Dizon.
He's
a former Tribune employee.
Really? What did you do here, Mike?
I worked here from 1995 to 2009. I started off in editorial covering Springfield and the
state. I knew your name sounded familiar, and then you went straight. Then you got like a real job.
A real job. I moved to the marketing department, and then I became the media spokesperson for the Tribune, the Chicago Tribune based properties.
Oh my God!
So, yeah, what a nightmare. It feels good to be back here.
Hey, I'm surprised you're not in a mental institution. You are now the co-chair of the Sesquicentennial Committee at Northeastern Illinois. Do you work for the university?
I work for the university. I'm currently their chief marketing and communications officer. The nice thing about Northeastern is that the university's mission is so similar to the Tribune companies or Chicago Tribune's mission too, so it was an easy transition.
That's great. Are you having fun up there?
Oh, absolutely. And Rich knows very well. It's just the spirit of the university, the unique audience that it serves. It's very gratifying to be a part of that.
Well, it's also a very, very diverse student body. Richard, when you were a young man in your senior year of high school trying to figure out what you wanted to do with your life, and you just said before we talked to Mike, you were toying with college?
It was not in the cards for me. I didn't think at the time. I came from a broken home. My mother, blue-collar depression in her family. When I announced to her that I would like to go to college, she looked at me in sheer disbelief, masked with horror. Well, nobody's going to college. We can't afford that. Nobody had, and my dad, who had considerable money and everything, he refused, didn't want to send me. And I just had a vague notion about, well, gee, I really want to do this. And I had a high school teacher at Taft High School who came up to me one day and she said, are you going to college? And I said, I don't think so. And she said, why not? I said, well, it's a variety of reasons. I really got to go to work. And she says, well, Richard, you know, you write, and you have a future in writing, maybe journalism, and you should do that. And she lit that fire underneath me. And then I explored ways to go to college. Northeastern was the very first college I applied for because two things. One, it was very close to where I worked.
Yeah.
I had to work 30 hours a week. I had to pay room and board and to support my mom. But I still wanted to go to college. So it was connecting the bus routes because I worked at Sears Roebuck at Six Corners. And sadly enough, that really factored into my decision. But Northeastern was the most affordable option. And to this day, Northeastern Illinois University, that is a high consideration for a lot of blue-collar families.
No question, Mike. I mean, you must see that on a constant basis these days. You know, it used to be, you know, Circle used to get a little of that, I think.
Right.
But, you know, certainly Northwestern, the big-name schools in the area, Northwestern, DePaul, Loyola, those are all private and expensive kinds of places. Does the university still have a lot of first-time family members going to college?
That's what we're known for.
Wow.
In fact, we serve a fairly unique population here in Chicagoland. Yes, it's true. Many of our students are not only first in their families to attend college, but they're non-traditional in that they tend to skew a little bit older. They're not typically what you think of when you think of college students, the 18 to 22-year-old students. We have a lot of those.
Oh, sure.
But these are folks who are working part-time. Many of them are commuting, some of whom are actually living on campus now that we have a residence.
You have residences there?
The very first opened up this past year.
Oh, my God. How has that changed the campus life?
Oh, it was transformative.
Yeah, well,
unfortunately, we were the last public university here in Illinois to have residence halls. Well, we finally got it. And that was in large part because our students were telling us, many of our prospective students were telling us, look, I'd really like to go to Northeastern, but I need a place to live.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Part of the thing, Rick, is that Northeastern has traditionally been seen since its inception as a commuter school. When I started, it was essentially a school where you were expected to graduate and teach in the public school system of Chicago.
Yeah.
It was a teacher's college. And it was a college that was known for accepting students who couldn't afford the other institutions.
It was in, I haven't read your book, but it was in Englewood then, was it?
Well,
not?
Initially.
It started in Blue Island?
It started in Blue Island. It was called the Cook County Normal School. And by definition.
Normal meaning what?
Normal is a derivative of the École Normale, which was a French school.
I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And essentially, it was a word for teacher college.
Yeah.
And the term has fallen into the vapors of history. In fact, the last exclusive normal school in the United States closed, I think, in 1971.
Hmm.
Because all the normal schools of that era are essentially today state universities.
Interesting. Interesting. We got to take a break, but we're going to talk for quite some time here. Mike Dizon, thank you for being here. Former Tribune Company employee, we're now called Tronc. And Richard Lindberg, one of the most prolific and best authors writing in Chicago. Richard's book, his latest, is Northeastern Illinois University, The First 150 Years. We'll talk about how this book came to be, the whole notion of celebrating a sesquicentennial. And also, especially for you, Mike, and you too, Richard, sort of identifying and giving a personality to Northeastern Illinois in the midst of all these big, flashy colleges. Do you know what I mean? It's how do you distinguish yourself? And I think this book will go a long way to do that. We'll be back in a couple minutes.
We're brave and gallant miner boys who work in underground. For courage and good nature, no finer can be found. We work both late and early and get but little pay.
Welcome back. I am talking for the next, for at least 40 minutes with my friend Richard Lindberg, my former colleague Mike Dizon. Mike's the co-chair of the Sesquicentennial Committee at Northeastern Illinois University, and Richard is the author of, I've just thumbed through, this incredibly handsome book, Northeastern Illinois University, The First 150 Years. Richard is an esteemed graduate of the school. You met your wife there, too. I didn't know that.
Yes.
So it's like the most full-service university in the Midwest, isn't
well,
it?
Well, it changed my life. It really did.
How so? It changed your life in the way that college should change your life, correct?
Well, if I didn't go to Northeastern, I can say quite honestly, I would probably be working in a factory on Northwest Highway up in the northwest side of Chicago.
Yeah.
My mother, that's the future she saw for me. My father was indifferent, and, it was essentially high school to work, and that was it. And I just looked upon it as kind of a bleak existence, and I thought to myself there had to be more. And then when I realized all my friends were going to college, I made a concerted effort. I applied to Northeastern. I was admitted
conditionally. Do you remember, Richard, do you remember what you felt like the first day of school? I know it's a silly question, but do you remember what you felt like the first day of school?
I was in awe. The first class I took was I was involved in debate in high school, and I took a debate class at North. My very first college experience, and it was filled with seniors, and they are really into the technical aspect of debate, and we had never gotten that in depth in high school, and these guys were smoking pipes, and they actually, they had the patches.
Sounds like the University
elbow.
Of Chicago, yeah.
Right. And I thought, oh, my God, what have I gotten myself into? And I dropped that class immediately, so it was a rough start. But then I
Wound up majoring in history.
There was nothing else I could have majored in. History has been my love since I was 5 years old. my love of Chicago history began in high school, and it accelerated. And I went back and got my master's degree from Northeastern in the 1980s because I needed the credentials to publish.
Yeah.
Because my goal was to publish history, and I needed a master's degree. And it was, again, a part-time thing. I was working full-time, and I took one course a semester, 8 years.
Mike, you've been there for Mike Dyson for 3 years. So this project came to you when it had already started, correct?
That's right. I think most of it was finished, or all of it was, Richard.
How did the book start, Richard? I mean, how
the book started through a very close friend and mentor, whose name was Dr. Bernard Brommel. He is one of the top two individuals who have donated so much money. In fact, the science building on campus is named Brommel Hall.
Wow.
He was a professor of mine in my senior year in speech. He was a speech professor. And he has kind of mentored me along. He got me involved with the Society of Midland Authors. He's a published author, wrote an exceptional biography. And he said, Richard, you have to write this history. No one else can do it but you.
Was it his idea? Or, I mean, it's, you know, okay, 150 years, it's a logical kind of landmark birthday to do. Was it his idea?
It was his idea. He had it in his mind. He called me up one day. He says, Richard, I want you to write the history of Northeastern.
And I guess if you've given a building to the university, you can sort of say, yes, I have another.
And
I know you love to write.
Yeah.
This is in its fashion, and now, frankly, seeing the book, it may seem like, well, oh, that's not going to be too hard. This is a daunting. It's a daunting project. You, any second thoughts before starting this, or because of your affection for the school and for history, you jump at it?
Well, I did it with affection for the school, but with great reservation. Because first I said, I always call Dr. Brommel Bernie. I said, does the university really want to do this? And he said, well, of course they do. I says, well, I haven't heard from the president, so I don't know. Mm-hmm. And she gave the go-ahead, and I had a meeting with her, and she said, let's do it. We don't have a history. At that time, it was so long ago, we didn't even know what the anniversary would be to bring it out. And then it crystallized that it was going to be 150 years. And the archives were fragmentary in terms of the early years of the Cook County Normal School. But the framework and the backbone, and I must say this unabashedly, was the Chicago Tribune. The first thing I did was I said, I need to build.
This is where Mike and I come into the story.
I need to build the skeleton. I always look at a book as a skyscraper.
Sure.
You dig the hole, you put in the beams, and that's what I did. And I searched the Chicago Tribune archives back to the 1850s, and I worked forward. Constantly working forward, moving forward to the modern era.
What was there much about it? I just got Mike Dyson has just brought me my copy of the book, and I'll devour it over the next week. But was there much about the early years?
No,
yeah.
There wasn't really. At least it was shrouded in a lot of myth and mystery. There was an apocryphal story that said that the first classes were held inside of a railroad boxcar in Blue Island. So I'm searching.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. That this is how it got started.
You know, Mike, that's like too good to be true. Yeah, yeah, it's one of those two guys or railroad bus.
In a little town called Blue Island, that was essentially a country town, a very pastoral, beautiful setting, that would later become absorbed into Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
I could find no evidence of that, and I frankly never determined where that story came from. But it had gained currency. Instead, what really happened was that the normal school movement began in the East Coast and was inspired by educator Horace Mann, mm-hmm. who had studied the new and evolving theories of education from Germany. And that involved essentially changing the way children are taught. In the 19th century, it was rote memorization. You learned by memorizing Shakespeare and formulas, and you read aloud, and you repeated, and you memorized. Horace Mann and his disciples decided that there needed to be more creative thinking and more individualism in bringing out the talents of the individual student. And this was the revolutionary change in American education.
Let me ask you guys are going to be on for for a long time. I haven't read the book, but wasn't Francis Parker, the educator Francis Parker, who has a school named after him, a school that could put 50 kids through Northeastern, I'm assuming, with that tuition, and a very innovative educator. Wasn't he involved with Northeastern Illinois
University? He was the second, at that time they were called principals. He was the second principal of Northeastern. He succeeded Mr. Wentworth, no relation to John Wentworth.
Right. I just asked.
But he came in 1883, and he continued the evolving mission of Wentworth, that we were going to create an educational model that was separate and apart. He called it the Quincy Method, which was his work in Quincy, Massachusetts.
He was an innovative.
He was innovative and controversial.
Yeah, exactly.
And he had a tremendous amount of political opposition from the city politicians and the Cook County politicians.
Oh, I can't wait to read about this guy.
And you know, we even bring in people like Mike McDonald and some of the crooks into this story.
Fantastic. how could you not? Yeah, have you ever? Yeah, I don't think Mike McDonald was in Whiskey Breakfast, but he's been a character in many of your books. I will carry on with these two nice guys. Mike Dysand is the Chief Marketing and Communications Officer for Northeastern Illinois University, and Richard Lindberg, the prolific author, has written what looks like, and it's a beautiful book, Northeastern Illinois University, the First 150 Years. We'll talk to them a great deal more about the book, and I want to talk to Mike about how one markets a university in this day and age. And in this particular environment where you've got, I want to build a new basketball arena, so here's $25 million, DePaul. And it's a very competitive market, is it not?
Oh, you know it.
Yeah. Well, we'll talk more about that. And I think this book will help distinguish Northeast Illinois University, Richard Lindberg's new book. So please stay tuned. These gentlemen are going to stay for a while. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago and WGNradio.com.
Way back yonder in Tennessee, they leased the convicts out, sent them working in the mine.
Welcome back to After Hours with me, Rick Hogan. That's the voice of Pete Seeger singing American Industrial Ballads from a relatively rare CD. I am in here for at least another half hour with Mike Dysand. That's what I'm still saying, right? He is the Chief Marketing Communications Officer for Northeastern Illinois University, and Richard Lindberg, who has given Mike what I think is an incredible marketing tool by having written the hot-off-the-presses, handsome-as-hell book, Northeastern Illinois University, the First 150 Years. Mike, you've only been at the university for about 3 years, so you came on while this project was about 2 years old, while Richard is in some basement sweating out the details.
Sweating out the details
and trying to write. Richard, a very prolific and unbelievably talented writer. Did you immediately sense how this kind of thing could help you marketing this university?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, even before I came to Northeastern, I was sort of shocked and surprised at just how long the institution had been around. 150 years says a lot, doesn't it? It tells us that, this is an institution that has a lot of stability. It has a history, very deep roots in Chicago and the community. And I think as you read this, as you read the book, like I have, and I was just telling you off the air, boy, it is an incredible book. And I have to believe that it couldn't have been easy to write and research it, but from the reader's perspective, it's incredibly easy to go through, and it's just the way it's written, Rich's style of writing. I plowed through it in about 2.5 nights.
Well, yeah, I think you're really right. You're now a great in addition to all your other professions and jobs. You're a great book critic too. It also will do, I think, a remarkable job. Plus, just the notion of the celebration in that. For generations, a lot of the people going to Northeastern were commuters. They don't have that sort of tie that people who lived on campus have. Don't you think this will reaffirm for a lot of people the importance of this university in their minds and their lives?
I think you can't help but read this book, especially from a graduate's perspective,
exactly.
A member of the alumni, not to really feel that strong affinity for Northeastern Illinois University. Knowing that you were a part of that history, no matter where in time you joined, whether it was in the 60s, 70s, 80s, whenever, there's something in the book for you and that you can relate to. And even if you don't have that affiliation with the university, it's an important Chicago record.
No question. I think that you've hit on something. And Richard, that had to be one of the underlying appeals of this book to you, because you are Chicago's historian, man. And
thank you.
No, I know you are. And that this is such a tale of Chicago as well as a place in Chicago.
Well, when I realized that there had not been a substantive history beyond a few research papers, dissertations, and pamphlets, I looked upon this as an opportunity to do a deep dig, an archaeological dig, if you will, into forgotten history, which is something I love to do. Moreover, it was the sense of loyalty to the university and the sense of gratitude I had for giving me that chance back in 1971 to become an undergraduate.
But also giving the university its due because, again, I have not yet read the book. It's sitting here handsomely on this desk. But what it did for you, it obviously did the same thing for thousands, if not tens of thousands of people over these years. And to give it its kind of due and the recognition that I think, given all the other universities and colleges in this area, many of them ultra high profile because they have basketball teams and football teams, that had to be important too. It's not like Northern Illinois University, like Rodney Dangerfield, didn't get any respect, but to help get it the respect it deserves.
When I was a freshman, the school essentially served white ethnic students from the Northwest side, mostly, you know, Taft, Foreman, Schurz High School, some of the suburban schools, and that was its identity. And these were working-class students, first-generation students, who left campus almost en masse at 1 o'clock in the afternoon to go to their jobs.
Yep.
And so getting a student life and a student awareness and identity was a great challenge to the university. They didn't stick around for the clubs. There was no real existing athletic program. In 1970, they started the football club, but it wasn't the team.
Yeah,
and they played at Willamette Park and so on. And so the campus would go empty for most of the afternoon. And then slowly, as the decades evolved, it became international in scope. And this began in the 1990s under the inspired leadership of a past president, Dr. Salmi Steinberg, who recognized that the future of Northeastern was tied to crossing international borders.
Interesting. Interesting.
And the first student exchange program commenced in the early 90s when, with Russia, of all places, former President Gordon Lamb initiated a student exchange and was a visiting scholar to Russia. And then the face of Northeastern really begins to change, I think, in the mid-1980s is the beginning point, and then accelerating through the
90s. When you were there, you helped change it.
Well,
you're not going to take credit.
No, I was just a student. I was a workaday student, and I did some work for the student newspaper, and I led some tours around campus. That was the extent of my involvement because I had to get to my job at Sears Roebuck.
Right.
You know, but it was really the administration and the high quality of the faculty that I think accounted for the remarkable transformation of Northeastern in the 90s. And what are we today as far as the U.S. News and World Report, Mike? I mean,
We're recognized as the number one most diverse public university in the Midwest.
Is that right?
We're also known as the number one school for adult learners, number one safest campus in the state of Illinois, number three in the country. We're mostly known for just how diverse we are. We have roughly...
How many students? I mean, I need to ask all these basic questions. How many students are there now?
About 9,500, full and part-time. When the school opened
graduate
up...
Graduate and undergraduate?
Yes.
When the school opened in September of 1961, the original enrollment was 1,764 students.
Wow.
At its peak... In the 1990s, it topped out at over 12,000. But see the constraints, the physical constraints of the campus, at least the main campus. We have three, but the main campus we're hemmed in, adding new buildings is a problem, and that has hindered the continuous growth.
Mike, when you were at some other job and you were, we got to take a break, but you guys are staying on. I'll be back with Mike Dizon, who is the Chief Marketing Communications Officer of Northeastern Illinois University, and Richard Lindberg, the prolific author who has spent 5 years, well, not 5 years writing it, but a few years writing Northeastern Illinois University, the first 150 years. And just if you're getting a sense from hearing these two guys, I cannot wait to start reading this book. And Mike just gave me a copy, and it's a Chicago story, ladies and gentlemen. It's a Chicago story about, can you just think of how many people learned at Northeastern. We'll be right back.
I once was a tool of oppression, as green as a sucker could be, and monopolies banded together.
Welcome back. That's Pete Seeger singing from a CD called American Industrial Bells, because tomorrow is Labor Day. And yes, you can have a picnic and you can go to the beach, but remember, it's a day that's meant to celebrate the working people of this country. My guest, Richard Lindberg, has been working for some years on a fabulous book, Northeastern Illinois University, the first 150 years, and Mike Dizon, a former Tribune slave, as I am, is the Chief Marketing and Communications Officer for Northeastern. Mike, what was it that appealed to working for Northeastern, if I can ask you? You came there about 3 years ago.
I did, and between the time I worked at the Chicago Tribune and Northeastern, I worked at two other universities, both of which were private, both of which were local. One was Northwestern University. The other was Dominican University,
sure,
in the River Forest area. And what I found so appealing about Northeastern was really not the fact that it's public, you know, which was very different from my previous universities, but it's a very unique student body. And there's something about the culture there that I found so different from anywhere else that I had worked at. These are folks who really take college seriously. I tell everybody that my two favorite days of the year are our commencement ceremonies, the one that we host in December, the one that we host in May. And it's my favorite because it's an incredibly emotional time, not only for the graduates who walk
the stairs,
yeah, for their families and for their friends who supported them, either financially, emotionally. It's so gratifying to see that, and it reminds me why I and so many of my colleagues continue to work there, and you won't find a more committed faculty and staff. I mean, just the entire community, yeah, alumni, friends, donors, students.
You have, and Richard Lindberg, you have, we were just going through it off air, some unbelievably distinguished, in addition to you and your wife, some terribly distinguished alums.
We have a number of former city council members.
Well, that's not that distinguished. even though there's some good aldermen, and Richard works for a very good one and the longest serving alderman in history of the city council, correct?
Yes, Alderman Ed Burke. I'm his speechwriter.
Yes.
But we have in that group Congressman Luis Gutierrez, who came into Northeastern probably about a year after I was done. He helped found the Union of Puerto Rican Students. He was politically active, and he got his foundation here at Northeastern. We've had Warner Saunders of WMAQ-TV, Robert Jordan of WGN, a number of poets, a number of authors, musicians, June Sawyers, noted Chicago historian and author. It's a roster, I think a very notable roster
it
of
is.
People who've made their bones in Chicago.
How were you when you were researching the book? And again, I haven't read it yet because it just arrived in my lap today. Did you talk to many alums in researching the history? You must have talked to a few.
Yes, I did. I worked with the Northeastern Alumni Association, and that is a marvelous group of people. And the first thing they did was bring together a group of alums from Chicago Teachers College South, our sister school.
Yeah.
Graduates from the 1940s and 1950s, and we had a dinner, and I interviewed each of them individually, and
they
were sharing with me the stories of going to the Englewood campus, and for $20 a semester, that's what they paid. This was in the 50s during the teacher shortage
still.
And the baby boom. They got themselves a full college education with the pledge of agreeing to become a teacher in the Chicago public school system. So they got their career mapped out for them, and it was only $20 a semester.
Oh, my.
And Chicago Teachers College South, of course, that was the new name for the old normal school.
Yeah, sure.
But the big split occurs in 1960 when, because of overcrowding of the schools and the constant demand for teachers, you and I, Rick, were kids back then.
Yeah.
But what I did not know in my research was that you had so many overcrowded schools that you literally had eighth grade students teaching the first graders because they didn't have anybody to teach.
Oh,
it was an explosion after World War II, and that necessitated the creation of a Northside campus. And
fascinating.
One of the interesting stories about the location at Bryn Mawr in St. Louis, it was adjacent to the grounds of the old Chicago Parental School, which was a kind of a quasi-reform school. It was for truants, and it was put out in the country at a time when
that was
the neighborhood
didn't
quite reach.
Yeah, yeah.
And then during World War II, they had after World War II, they built metal Quonset huts on that location for displaced people coming back from Europe after the war. You had metal Quonset huts. And then those were removed, and it was an empty field. And Benjamin C. Willis, who was a controversial—
Willis Wagons.
Oh, Willis Wagons, yes, absolutely. The controversial Chicago Public School superintendent identified this as the ideal location for the North Side extension of the South Side Teachers College.
Yeah, fascinating, fascinating. Mike, what else? You must be, as the head of the chief marketing and communications officer, to celebrate this 150 years, are there big plans beyond? I think the book itself is celebration enough, but you're going to take advantage of this anniversary. You know,
oh, definitely. We
what
have,
do you have planned?
Well, not only am I the chief marketing and communications officer, I'm actually the co-chair.
That's right, the co-chair of the
NEIU 150, which is our nickname for our sesquicentennial celebration. Not many people can say sesquicentennial. It's sort of a difficult word.
Yeah.
But NEIU 150 is what we're calling it, and it's essentially a year-long really an academic year-long celebration that's going to be kicked off on September 15th and 16th. On a weekend that is known as NEIU Weekend. It's sort of a new tradition at Northeastern. It's essentially our homecoming. And on the 15th and 16th, we have a number of fun activities, family events, including a fall festival, a family picnic, and then a more formal gala coming up. And you know that Rich Lindberg is going to be there talking a little bit about his book, signing books, and it'll be available for sale there. But we're really excited about this. We'll have events planned throughout the year. You know, 150-year anniversary only comes once in a lifetime.
Yeah.
We're gonna celebrate it right in an appropriate way for our community.
Well, that's great. It gives you this chance to punctuate the place this university has in Chicago. I'm all for that. You can get all sorts of information, ladies and gentlemen. It's a very easy website, NEIU NEIU.edu. See, Northeastern Illinois University, NEIU.edu. And people can, I'm assuming through that website, too, order copies of the book.
Yeah, and if you want to find an easier way, neiu.edu/150.
Okay.
And you'll find instruction, not only more information about the book and about Rich Lindberg, the author, but instructions on how they can buy that.
That's great. And how they can also, I just go to the regular website and start to, if you're a graduate, or even if you went there and had to leave for some reason, I mean, that a place like that will work its way into your heart in the way, you know, a Notre Dame might too, I suppose, but I got problems with Notre Dame. but this is a place where so many first-generation college graduates went.
Yeah, the 80,000-90,000 graduates who have earned their degree from Northeastern fall into that category.
How are your alums? Are they active? Do you have an active alumni?
Oh, we do. The Alumni Association was reinvigorated at the beginning of the new millennium. The first one came in the 1970s, and it went fallow.
Yeah, sure.
It took a recognition by the university that the community of alums could actively support the school. The challenge was they didn't have the same traditional college experience of, say, somebody who goes to Notre Dame or Michigan. They didn't have the same connection because they were commuter students.
Exactly.
So how deep was their loyalty to the school? But we have seen, especially in the last couple of years with the budget crisis in Springfield, that the alums have risen to the challenge. There have been a number of challenge grants that have been launched, and our alums have come through. It's still the process of reengagement is ongoing, but we have an alumni head, Damaris Tapia, who's done a wonderful job of bringing back people to campus. And one of the strategies was to even include the Southside graduates.
That's great.
So that they have a sense of identity and belonging that they can join with us. And, of course, the Southside campus is today Chicago State.
Right. Yeah. Beleaguered because of budget. Beleaguered for a lot of reasons.
A tragic story.
Yeah. Stay for a few more minutes, you guys. You hear the news again, and then I'm going to ask you a couple more questions, and then I'll let you go, and then I can go home and read this book.
Okay. When the farmer comes to town with his wagon broken down, oh, the farmer is the man who feeds them all. If you'll only look and see, I think you will agree that the farmer is the man who feeds them all. Oh, the farmer is the man, the farmer is the man, lives on credit.
Pete Seeger, ladies and gentlemen, from American Industrial Ballads in honor of Labor Day, which is tomorrow. We have a few more minutes with Mike Dyson, who is the Chief Marketing and Communications Officer, as well as the co-chair of the Sesquicentennial Committee. And its sesquicentennial means 150 years, and that is in the title of Richard Lindberg's latest book, Northeastern Illinois University, The First 150 Years. I have not read it yet because it's so hot off the presses that it's burning a hole in my briefcase. They brought it in here. Richard, before, I'm going to ask you first, Mike. What would surprise listeners most to learn, without reading the book yet, to learn about Northeastern Illinois University?
Oh, wow. What a great question. So two things, really. One is, as I was reading it, I found really surprising, maybe you noted this too, Rich, that how history repeats itself. Yes. And how just even the characters, the personalities, you sort of see them come and go. The second thing that I got out of the book was I finished that book really with an even stronger sense of pride in the institution. I finished the book feeling like, boy, there really isn't any challenge that is so insurmountable. I mean, we've been around for 150 years.
That says
we'll
a great deal.
We'll be around for another 150. that, you know, the past 2 years with the state budget crisis has been really difficult.
Oh, I'm sure the challenges.
But it was a replay of what happened in 1931. The normal school itself was almost closed down in the height of
the Depression.
The Great Depression.
Yeah.
And, you know, I also feel like it's a reflection of our students. You know, if we can survive, it's in part because we take inspiration from the 80,000 students who have walked, who have left the university with a degree. We're hoping that many of them will show up at NEIU weekend on the 15th and
16th. Yeah, sure.
Like I said, it's an incredible book. And no matter where you're coming from or who you are or what your perspective is, whether you have an affiliation with the university or not, it's an interesting read, and I think people will enjoy it.
Richard, what surprised you? You obviously had some knowledge of the place just because you're a historian and you went there and you majored in history. What surprised you most in researching and writing this book?
Well, that's a challenging question. I think that I was aware of it. Of course, I'd been off campus for many years.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
The cultural and demographic change of the university from the time I graduated and got my bachelor's degree in 1974 to the new millennium now. I mean, this university is a United Nations of people. So different than my first glimpse of it in 1970.
As you said, in yours it was mostly white working class kids.
Right, white ethnics from the northwest side of Chicago. But we also have two campuses. We have our El Central campus off of Kimball, and we have the Jacob Carruthers Center, which is down on Oakwood Boulevard on the south side. So we have three active campuses, and they serve varying constituencies of people. But it's the international flavor of the school that is, to me, the biggest the most transformative thing, I think.
That would also be, not to act like a PR guy for the university, but that would also, I like the size of it. It's not Ohio State. There aren't 40,000 people there. There's an intimacy to it, but also that world nature. That's the kind of world we're going to be living in, this cross-cultural, cross-thing that you can get to know that kind of scene on a much more intimate level while you're while you're absorbing knowledge, you're also absorbing societal
stuff. It's a metaphor of globalization. And it began in the mid-1990s and with echoes and stirs, and now it is it's the motto, work in the city.
Learn in the city and lead in the world.
Yes, that's the motto of the university.
Wow.
And I anticipate that it'll become even more international once word starts to get out that we have a residence hall. And big part of the reason why we have it is not only because our students told us that they want.
Because it's hard to take a bus back to Thailand every day. It's hard to commute from
Thailand.
It was a gamble, but
sure.
It's one that's going to pay off. We have the Nest, as it's called, which is on campus, and then the other building is going to be at the intersection of St. Louis or Bryn Mawr and Kimball Avenue.
Yeah.
So it's going to be, we're finally expanding off of the grid that we have had, and over the years, one of the other things was the controversy with the neighbors because there was never enough parking.
Sure.
And as the university grew from 1,700 students to 10,000, you can imagine, all the difficulties.
No question. But it is a nice little section of Chicago. There's no doubt about it. Mike Dyson, keep me up to date on other events going on for the sesquicentennial, because I'm sure they're going to be all during the next year, starting September.
Our big one is starting September 15th and 16th, and we're going to, like I said, it's a year-long celebration. We expect to cap it off around May or so with another bookend event. And while the event that's taking place on the 15th and 16th is sort of a retrospective look at our last 150 years, we're really excited about, or equally excited about, the May event, which we intend to focus on the next 150 years.
Interesting.
Northeastern pays a lot of attention to and acknowledges its history the past 15 decades, but just as much we are interested in the future.
Sure.
And so the May event will be more visionary. It'll be not just what the next 150 years could look like for Northeastern, but for Chicago in general.
And yeah.
We have people, we have the faculty who have that vision, and we expect that they're going to be a big part of that.
That's great. You better do a second printing of this book, I'll tell you that right now, if you're going to do another big event in May. Richard, you can really I'm excited to read the book, not only because just from talking to the two of you, it tells a very exciting story that is
interwoven with politics.
Is a Chicago, yeah. Is it, if Mike McDonald's in the book, then how Mike McDonald and Francis Parker in one book, how can you miss? And the fact that you don't talk much about meeting your wife in there, do
no,
you?
No.
No, but he did, Richard did meet his wife. It's a full service university for Richard Lindbergh, I will tell you that. Richard, congratulations. You can be really proud of yourself.
Thank you, Rick.
I think
nice
you can. And Mike, it's great to see you. And
good seeing you,
take
too.
Advantage of this book. I think you're at a very, very interesting place at Northeastern Illinois University.
Sure.
The book is Northeastern Illinois University, the first 150 years. You can go to neiu.edu to learn much more about it. You people are smart. You'll be able to find all the 150th anniversary stuff. Gentlemen, thank you.
Greatly
appreciate it, and happy Labor Day to you. We'll be back momentarily with the one and only Lise Graham.
Come all you hardy miners and help us sing this song, sung by some union men for 100,000 strong. With John White, our general.
If you like this CD, American Industrial Ballads, sung by Pete Seeger, tune in tomorrow from noon to 3 when I'm filling in for John Williams, because I will play you more of it. I have 6 guests coming on tomorrow from noon to 3 because it's Labor Day in honor of the unions and labor and working people and the 8-hour day. I decided to work for 3 hours. One of the hardest working people I know is the young, not so young anymore, producer of this show, Lise Graham, who turned 24 a couple days ago. Happy birthday.
Thank you.
You really are a hard worker. When I first met you, and I don't know how long we've been collaborating on this show, probably 6 months, mm-hmm. something like that. So, well, I'm going to do this. You're a very creative young woman. And a very hardworking young woman, and you are terribly personable, too. All the guests say, oh, your producer was so nice to me. You started Lise FM as a podcast to explore the reasons behind what creative people do. Is that sort of the description of
Perfect.
It?
Perfect. I'll start using that as my tagline.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, because it's recorded. You can do it.
Exactly.
You didn't do it, at least I think, as one of the many people I've met over the years in this nutty business, because I want to have a radio show. I got to have a radio show. It was something, your motivation was vastly different, wasn't it?
Yeah. Well, okay. So I started thinking of this idea based on the fact that I've got a ton of friends in the music scene in Chicago, starting out, you know, with all these great bands. But now, you know, it's hard to kind of display that to people. So
sure.
I wanted to appeal to the listener by saying, hey, this is a band that also is influenced by David Bowie and the Beatles and, you know, Prince or whatever.
Yeah.
So you like those musicians, like these guys like those musicians. That's who they, you know, were brought up on. Here's their
music.
But
that's always an interesting thing to explore because, you know, nobody pops out of Lake Michigan fully formed and ready to play rock and roll or jazz or folk or rap or hip hop or any other kind of music. Everybody is influenced by what has come before, and it's very interesting. I think it's been interesting for you, hasn't it, to discover what. You've been surprised, too, haven't you?
I have. And it's funny. So it started as this music thing. And my first 3 episodes, I had 3 different friends' bands come on. And then I was kind of like, okay, wait, but like everything has an influence, you know. So I got my first filmmaker on, Giancarlo Iannata, who made this beautiful Italian-American film, both here in Chicago and then also in Molise, which is an area in Italy. And that was fascinating because he didn't only call on other movies as his influences. He called on music. He called on WGN, actually, as an influence. And then I got Amy Guth on there, a writer. You know, she's just a Renaissance woman. And she had all these different, you know, different music that influences her writing. And it's just spiraled into this amazing, like...
Well, it's an exploration, I think again, not to describe what you do, but Lisa FM is a kind of exploration of creativity.
Yeah.
What makes it? Because it is the end product. It's like what's the recipe? You know, that's what you're trying to discover is what the recipe is for that. And it has nothing to do with your birthday. But you receive some news around your birthday about Lisa FM, and you seemed as excited as you can be in a text.
Yeah.
You seem very excited when you
texted
me.
5 exclamation points.
What is it?
So, this is from Stephanie Menendez, my lovely boss. Told me that it will be included on the WGN Plus website, so in the WGN podcast network,
which is great. That's a big deal.
It is.
It?
And what better first episode to have my
yeah,
so it was like my 18th
me.
Episode I interviewed
me.
You, which
over
thank
two
you.
Days no
it
it's
was
my
great.
Pleasure over 2 days because I don't always you want to hear some
so I pulled a little clip from our talk about I asked you, well, we had a long conversation, it's about an hour and a half, but further into it, we got to finally your radio career, and I talked to you about
my so-called radio career.
Oh please. About who you looked up to, or you know, what kind of things you drew upon when you started hosting. So
now Aubrey will play.
Aubrey,
this.
Go ahead.
Let's talk about like radio influence, or like who do you embody when you get in front of a mic? Or it's just you, I know.
Nobody.
But, like, did you listen to?
If there's a model, you know, I've always felt that the one gift, if it is a gift that you can give, that you owe listeners is sincerity. I've heard too many people who are insincere and even worse, phony on the radio. They will do whatever it takes or what they think will get listeners. I spent a lot of time over the years with Howard Stern in his studio in Manhattan and watched him work. And you can think whatever you want about Howard Stern and the kind of person he is and the subject he is who he is. That is the reason he is arguably the most successful radio disc jockey, and certainly financially, in the history of this medium. He never had to fake it. He never had to pretend that he wasn't the sophomore in high school who was allowed to ask the questions a sophomore in high school would like to ask. He did have a pretty big staff helping him, and I knew that too was important. There are too many people I've seen in this business who think that they all by themselves are interesting enough to stay on the air for an hour or 2 hours or 3 hours a day. They don't have guests. They read the paper and will comment. I don't care what someone, a disc jockey in Chicago, thinks about. Yes, it's sad in Houston. Interview somebody from Houston. Call Houston. I know it's a terrible tragedy. What would happen is if Jesus Christ came back, right? And he came to Todd and Todd Manley and Stephanie Menendez here and said, yes, I'm Jesus and I'm back and I'm wondering if I could have a, you know, 4-hour show at some time during the days. Well, of course they would say, if you've gone to anybody else, Jesus, and you come to us and we have exclusive on you, they'd say yes. But even Jesus, you couldn't have on for 4 hours a day because eventually you'd go, people would be calling in and go, hey, don't tell that bread and loaves story again. You told that 3 days ago. What's the matter with you? Get a guest or something. I don't want those same stories. I know your dad. You have more. No more stories about your dad, okay? It can't be done. And I think that's one of the things. That's why I always, I can be modestly interesting over a couple cocktails in a bar, but I'm not that interesting. You know what? I lead a pretty interesting life because I interview interesting people. And so that's why I like to have people on about whom I am curious. How did you write this book? Why did you make this album? Why did you? Who are you? Where do you come from? What do you want to do? Why do you do what you do? Well, who would want to listen to that? This Lisa FM is going to be a disaster.
Okay.
This Lisa FM is going to be a disaster.
I do want to say, so we had that second session of our interview, and then I was all hopped up because it was such a good conversation, despite what you say.
Yeah.
And I went to my second city class. This is the first session of this next class that I'm taking. And funnily enough, we had to start. It's a web series class, so we're writing a whole web series. A web series is like a TV show, but like each episode's 2 or 3, 5 minutes long.
Yeah.
And so we're writing this web series as a class. So we all have to get up there and write down our influences. And I'm like, that's hilarious because I just recorded this episode of my podcast. So the categories of our influences, it was really interesting. It was like recent influences of non-visual and then visual. So, yeah, you are number one on my...
I thought it was going to be Jesus Christ. Does this change the way you're going to do Lisa FM now that it's available on WGNRadio.com?
Hopefully not.
WGN Plus.
Yeah. No, I don't know. I haven't talked to Steph or Todd about it. So I think that I've done enough episodes. I've done 18 episodes now. And I think they probably get that it's kind of all over the place because my guests are all over the place.
That's good, though. The eclectic nature of it, yeah. I think, from just what you've told me about it, is going to be one of the things that makes it a success.
That's not what I hope.
The same thing, and it is interview heavy.
Yes.
It's not, hi, I'm Lise Grant, just turned 24, and this is what I think about the world.
And I have pink hair now.
Yeah, you do have pink hair. She does have pink hair. You're the best. You're
Thank
a great
you.
Producer, and you are a terrific person. You're going to be in here early producing for Dave Plyer, mm-hmm. who is in for
Steve Cochran.
Steve Cochran, and then I don't know who's after that, but I'm on from noon to 3 trying to fill in for John Williams. We'll be talking Al Capone, among many, many things. Richard Lindbergh was just here. He was an expert on Al Capone. So how do people find Lisa FM?
All right, for the time being, I'm not sure when it's going to be on the WGN Plus website, so I will make a big announcement on the show when it is. But actually, I'm available on all podcast apps right now. So iTunes, Podcast Addict. You could also find it on SoundCloud. Just search Lise, LISE.FM.
Good.
In SoundCloud.
Listen.
Hey, thank you.
Listen, Rick Hogan ramble. Thank you, hon. thank you all for listening. Thanks, Aubrey Mumpower, for engineering. And thank you, Lise Graham, for just being Lise Graham. Ugh. Happy birthday, honey.
Hey, happy almost birthday.
That's right. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago and WGNRadio.com.